Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, August 26th, 2000. In the fireside room this morning, we have John DeGraff. Today's session is entitled, Using Television to Promote Social Change. Think globally, act locally. Let's listen in.
Wonderful day, and thank you, Alan. Again, thank everybody who made it that way for me. My family and I just had a wonderful time here, and obviously hope to be back. But this particular session is entitled Think Globally, Act Locally, and you've probably all seen that bumper sticker on somebody or another's car, but it really says to maybe try to do the little things in your community, the little projects and things, but that also also understand their relationship to the wider world and what that means. I'm going to show one 30-minute program all the way through today, and then I think it'll open up some discussion in the final 20 minutes or so that we have left in the session. This is the story of a, I think, quite remarkable farm, a local organic farm, and its relationship to the community and its understanding of its place in the wider world of agriculture. And so I'll just start that. We'll open it up to questions when it's done. You can hit the lights there. Thanks. It take a little while. I just had to rewind it so it may take a
We're able to feed a lot of people on a very small piece of land, using some time-honored practices.
I really wish the Sheikh and niece were located right next to Michael's farm, because it's very important that he's growing those vegetables for flavor, that he's taking care of the land for future generations, that he's thinking about my nourishment and my good health.
Only a generation ago, the Goleta Valley, just north of Santa Barbara, California, was still mostly farms and orchards. It's different now.
I understand what's happening.
All that remains of what was once an agricultural cornucopia is a 12-acre island in a suburban sea. It is a fragile but magical island, alive with the fragrance and colors of fruits and vegetables, with the sounds of animals and people. Time and again, this tiny farm has been almost lost to development, yet it has somehow survived and continues to prosper. Fairview Gardens has become a model of sustainable food production and an inspiration for thousands of people.
The hidden agenda behind a lot of our community efforts was very simply to get this community to identify with this land as if it was their own. We were successful in that. The point was that if they identified with it in that way, that when the time came and the place was threatened, which I knew it would come, that people would rise up, and they did.
Customers who depend on this farm for at least part of their daily sustenance.
We're feeding 400 to 500 families through farmers markets, a community membership program, and produce stand.
It wasn't like that at all when Michael Abelman first came here.
20 years ago, there was 6 rows of peach trees. There was the original avocado orchard, and a few little haphazard sections of row crops here and there. And certainly the land was not farmed as intensively, not even close to what we're now doing. I actually came to this land because I was asked to graft the orange trees that were here. I was the local grafter in this county.
Back then, a young man named Chris Thompson was running the farm. Soon after Michael was hired, Chris left for another job. The owners of the land, an elderly couple with an interest in organic farming, asked Michael to manage it.
I don't have any formal training. Nobody really taught me how to farm. I was always the kind of person that read the directions after I used the product.
His education began with a morning walk.
My method of farming is based on what I consider to be the most important agricultural skill, and that is observation.
As he has most days since first arriving here, Michael Abelman traverses the farm from one end to another, looking carefully at his crops and taking notes.
After a while, you begin to notice the subtle changes that are taking place in the soil, in the shininess of the leaves of the plants, in the bark and the fruit. You look closely, you see what's happening amongst the insect life on the farm, and you learn an incredible amount in a 20 or 25 minute or half hour walk. People are constantly surprised at what little subtle thing I'm aware of in every corner of the farm. Because I have observed and walked this land day after day after day, watching the subtle changes and beginning to understand what happens. And because after a while, the plants tell you what they need.
Even on a little farm like this one, there is, of course, much more to consider than proper care of the plants. Like most small farmers, Michael had to learn how to repair old equipment and keep it running. That wasn't easy. The entire farm was undergirded with metal pipes. Through the years, specialized crops had been grown on the land. Each required a different irrigation system.
I found them all with the tractor. I ran into everything.
Never seen this, something like this happen.
Galvanized pipes and the rippers and the disc. I ran into valves. And that's how I discovered what was where.
In the early 1980s, urban sprawl discovered the Goleta Valley. Hundreds of acres of farmland were rezoned for residential development.
I began to see that the neighborhood was changing, that the Goleta Valley was no longer an agricultural region. I knew that if this place was going to survive economically, that we had to change our direction and our focus to appeal to the thousands of people that were moving in and around us.
It was time to diversify. Michael and his crew began planting other crops.
Lettuce and broccoli and carrots and cabbage and potatoes and on until before I knew it, this place had been colored in with 100 different fruits and vegetables, incredibly diverse.
Buy the tasty organic produce being grown at Fairview Gardens and sold at several local markets. The farm began to prosper.
In the early days, we never talked about organic. We never used that word. We gave people a tree-ripe peach to taste. When we first started selling corn at the produce stand, some people would almost faint when they'd encounter an earworm. And it took us a long time to educate people to the fact that the sign of an earworm is a sign that no poisons have been used.
Blessed with skilled co-workers who could help to run the farm, Michael was occasionally able to take time off and travel, especially during the winter. One of his first trips took him to mainland China.
What I saw completely blew my mind, really. There was this expanse, as far as I could see, this amazing network of fields of vegetables surrounded by waterways and pathways, all being worked by families working together in these fields. And this land was land that not only had been worked by these people's parents and grandparents, but by their great-grandparents and their great-great-grandparents, and in some cases all the way back for some 4,000 years, the same land. And I thought to myself, well, wait a minute, you know, how could these people maintain the same land 4,000 years when we can deplete ours in this part of the world, in some cases, in a decade, 10 years?
What began with a trip to China became, in succeeding years, a journey through five continents, camera in hand.
I had studied photography, but my photography was art for art's sake without any particular voice. I didn't have a story to tell. Suddenly, a photographer who had been dormant for so long and a farmer found a common voice. And I began photographing like crazy.
In time, his slides would become a book called From the Good Earth, filled with powerful images of land and people.
I was fascinated by what I had heard about what was going on in the Andes, in the mountains of Peru, where people were farming land that was so steep that farmers had been known to fall out of their fields. I witnessed fields of potatoes the size of most people's front lawns, with some 30, 40 varieties in a single field.
Such diversity, the farmers explained, helped keep pests in check.
I spent another winter in Africa, which was fascinating as well. I traveled to visit the Hopi in Arizona to see how a people could survive in really one of the harshest climates, often without irrigation water. And I began to develop this sense that there were some things that we could learn from these traditional cultures.
He brought along photographs of Fairview Gardens to show farmers in other countries what he and his colleagues were doing at home. On one excursion, he traveled with a companion through the wheat fields of Sicily. They were welcomed everywhere as honored guests.
It got to the point, quite literally, where everywhere we left with arms full of homemade pasta sauce in bottles, or olive oil, or wine, or bread, or cheese. And the car smelled like a traveling delicatessen. The poorer the people were, the more they offered you.
His hosts had few material goods, but they were rich in other ways. In their connections to the land, in their relationships to each other, in culture, tradition, and community. Back in the United States, Michael saw things less endearing. Vast acreage planted to a single crop, immensely susceptible to pests and disease, and protected only by floods of chemicals. Small farmers forced out of business, selling their land to giant conglomerates. Tasteless, uniform produce, packaged in plastic and transported across continents. In the Central Valley of California, where 40% of America's vegetables are grown, he found a stark and silent landscape.
The first thing that I noticed was it was absolutely desolate. Where were the people? There were no families working the fields. I didn't see any birds. There were no insects buzzing. All of that I could see were these flat fields, often with a single tractor, you know, maybe moving its way along.
Where, too, was the welcome he'd found all over the world?
They didn't want me there. I had to lie. I had to tell them that I was photographing for a school project in order to do what I was doing. The only people who entered those fields were people who had paid $1,000 to be led across the border and shipped like baggage to harvest and to hoe, period. Everything else was done by machines. I really responded in a very kind of, really a very emotional way to what I was experiencing. After I saw what was going on visually, I felt driven to learn a little bit more about why it was happening and what exactly was happening.
The facts, gleaned from books and scientific reports, were no less alarming than what he'd seen. He learned that 46 acres of prime American farmland is converted to non-agricultural uses every hour. That California is losing topsoil at a rate 80 times faster than nature can rebuild it. The average bite of food eaten in America travels more than 1,000 miles from field to plane, requiring an immense expenditure of energy. That pesticides poison 70,000 Americans and 1 million people worldwide every year, sometimes fatally. And that chemical agriculture is the largest source of groundwater pollution in the United States.
We pay less for food than any country in the world, but we're paying for it in our health, we're paying for it in the loss of topsoil, in the pollution of groundwater, and the people who are doing the work are paying for it.
Troubled, Michael Abelman looked elsewhere in the United States for signs of hope. And he found them in farmers markets, urban gardens, and other organic farms. There was a movement afoot all around the country, seeking a new relationship with the land and with food, and he was glad to be part of it. The farm grew increasingly productive and successful, finding new markets for its produce. But it was the calm before the storm. Farming is always a risky proposition. Too little rain or too much, an entire planting can be lost to a single cloudburst. By the late 1980s, weather was the least of Michael Abelman's worries. Fairview Gardens was endangered. Almost overnight, the entire area adjoining the farm began filling up with houses.
It was really an assault. The construction would start at 7 o'clock every morning and would go straight through the day all the way till evening. There was dust everywhere. The noise was horrible, and it went on for months. They had 20, 25 different pieces of very heavy machinery over there operating all day long. It was like a war zone. That land next door was riparian habitat. There was tons of life. There was deer and possum and raccoons and coyote and hundreds of different types of birds.
In a matter of months, it was all gone. Fairview Gardens was completely encircled by houses and strip malls.
Then the moving van started lining up. The kids that moved in gravitated here. They started playing on our compost piles and building forts in the orchards.
But their parents began to complain.
They weren't used to living next to a farm. They weren't used to hearing roosters crow early in the morning. I did have a neighbor call, left me a message on my answering machine that said that he would rather look over his fence at condominiums, and that the dust from the tractor was ruining the plaster in his pool.
At first, they were maddest about the compost.
Sometimes it would get a little smelly during the summer. A lot of flies flying around. So there was a time there that, you know, where some of the neighbors and myself would get upset about that.
I see the borders of the farm is extending beyond the edges of the fields. We provide the nourishment for the local community, and in turn, we should be receiving waste and material being generated by the community. We should use that recycle it.
His neighbors disagreed. They demanded that the piles be removed and got a letter from the health department ordering Fairview to stop composting.
Oh.
I was threatened with jail time over that compost. What we did, though, is we invited all the neighbors over for dinner. We served them a homegrown meal. And we talked about what their needs were, what we were trying to do here.
The neighbors agreed to let the compost. But a year later, the complaints resumed. Mm-hmm. Seems that some of the newcomers were getting less sleep than they'd been used to. They blamed the roosters, demanding their removal from the farm.
This proved to be a much more drawn-out, expensive battle. Eventually, there was a big hearing at the county, where the county officials suggested in all earnestness that we cut the vocal cords of the offending beasts. My sister's a family court judge in the state of Delaware. Her comment was that if she, as a judge, is in the place of judgment on this case, she would recommend cutting the vocal cords of those doing the complaining.
For every neighbor who complained, another came forward to defend the farm.
That was really a neat place to go and visit when I first started going over there, because you can just walk around the farm and, you know, look at all the activities that are happening. And it kind of just draws you in immediately.
They got a lot of people out to the farm, and I think that's what started getting it in everybody's mind, that this was really a treasure that they had in the community that really deserved to be protected and taken care of.
The rooster riot, as the incident came to call, brought a flood of supporters to a public hearing, and in the end, the county backed down.
Most people who complain have actually come to appreciate this, often through their kids, who turn out to be the best ambassadors.
They love to come out here and run around the trees. They love to come and play hide and seek. As long as there's not too many kids, Michael doesn't mind it. If they're real quiet, they're not doing anything they shouldn't be doing, if they're respecting the property, then he's okay with it.
How many of you have been on a farm before?
On an April afternoon, children from a neighborhood school come to visit Fairview Gardens. Together with their teachers, they are introduced to several of the crops grown on the farm.
Smell it and then pass it around, okay? How does that smell? Isn't that nice?
There is time for play, chance to crawl through the asparagus forest. There's a lesson in the avocado growing.
Soil is what we depend on for our food and for our lives. Very important. Okay?
Every tour ends with a treat.
You have to be very careful so the parents don't play, and we'll watch them for you right over here.
We hear from people all the time, "My children are eating vegetables." Those kids have come out here. They know the people who are producing them. They see the fields where they're coming from. And they're eating food that was picked that day, so it actually tastes like something.
Each year, more than 5,000 people walk through this farm.
There are no fences that we've put up on the edges of the farm. There's no keep-out signs. There are no pesticides being used. It's pretty much an open-door policy here.
Signs throughout the garden allow for self-guided tours.
The more I spent time around the farm, I think the more Mike and I became encouraged to grow more stuff here at home. And now even my youngest sister, who's an actress and a very flamboyant individual, is starting to grow plants and get bad hair.
They kept the compost, they saved the roosters, they reached out to the community through educational tours and public events. And their organic produce was increasingly popular. But by 1993, Fairview Gardens faced another threat, the most dangerous threat the farm had ever faced.
This
place was zoned for 52 condominiums.
The owners of the land were under pressure to sell it to developers, and that would mean the end of the farm. There was only one way out. Michael and his colleagues would have to form a non-profit organization and buy the land themselves.
We had to raise $750,000. I didn't have a penny of it.
First, they needed $25,000 for an option guaranteeing that developers couldn't buy the farm before they raised the money.
Hello, John? Yeah, this is Michael Abelman calling.
Well, I made two phone calls, calling up to ask someone for money. It's hard to do. First one said yes, I'll give you $10,000, boom. The second one said yes, give you $15,000. There we had it. We signed the option papers, the clock was running.
They have 1 year to find the rest of the money.
I realized I had bitten off a big chunk. There were people who told me it could not be done. And there were many nights that I woke up wondering how the hell we were going to pull this off.
But once again, local supporters of the farm rallied around it, raising money wherever they could.
We had wonderful people who came through and helped lead this effort and you know, went to their friends and to various foundations.
In 8 months, they raised $800,000, enough to purchase and preserve the farm as a land trust for future generations. On a Saturday afternoon in June, Enrique and Yolanda Correa, professional musicians from Oakland, stop by to visit the farm and offer an impromptu concert to the crew.
It's a fairly diverse network of people who are involved here. We have people from Mexico who are involved with field work. We've got interns. People who come all the way from Europe, from the East Coast, from the Northwest, to learn in a hands-on way what, you know, what we're doing, how we're doing it. When interns come here, I surprise them when I tell them that what I want them to do every day is to walk around with a small notebook and take notes of what they're observing.
He told us to write down what you're noticing from week to week. What does the tree look like this week? Is it producing fruit? Is it not? Are there insects on it? What, if so, what do they look like? I read Michael's book and it really inspired me to want to come here. You never get a day off, but you're surrounded by all of this life all of the time. I'm getting a master's in environmental education, so it was good for me for myself to find this, but also so I can teach children about it in the future.
I'm immersing myself in it. I want this to be part of my life, part of everybody's life, in a bigger way. I don't think that farming should just be something that certain people do and nobody else knows about. One of the best things is working out in the field with the Mexican workers, just practicing my Spanish. It's a lot of fun.
Para vender aquí, ¿no?
He says that the ones that are red on top are good because we're going to sell them here, and the other ones are not because they're so hard. You could transport them to Chicago and sell them there.
Work, guys. Go for it.
Over the years, the farmers here have steadily increased their understanding of organic methods. Instead of using chemicals, they rely on natural predators and carefully nourished soil to help control pests.
If you don't sleep for 5 days straight, if you don't eat well, eventually you get sick. Plants are similar. If plants are grown in soil that is fertile, it's well balanced, they're grown at the right time of year, generally there are no pest problems.
These are planted weeds, and they're planted not for our own
nourishment, but for the nourishment of the soil.
Natural fertilizers keep the soil and the plants rich and healthy.
We plant a mixture of legumes before the winter rains. Legumes have the ability to fix nitrogen on their roots from this sea of nitrogen that we live in. We plant things like vetch, Austrian peas, and fava beans. You get the advantage of all that organic matter, and we also get the nitrogen. That's one of the key practices that we have here, very important.
Yields per acre on this farm are about double those achieved by large-scale commercial growers using chemicals. One day each week, members of Fairview Gardens at CSA drop by to pick up their produce. CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture.
People make up a sort of a social contract with us. They agree to subsidize a portion of our farm budget in order to help us at a time of the year when we need income, the winter time. We use their investment to purchase seeds, tools, pay our labor costs and water and whatever else we might have to get crops going so that by the time we begin our CSA season, which is in mid-March, we have something to offer to them. And then they reap the benefit of their investment throughout our 37-week season by coming and picking up their produce once a week here at the farm.
It's important to us to feel like we're part of the community. And of course, it's really important to us that our children get pesticide-free food and as organic as possible. It means a lot to us as well.
We'll send you some stuff today. Okay, I can probably do that. And then whatever asparagus we can swing to. All right, thank you. Okay, bye.
We have a marketing philosophy that has our food mostly sold locally and directly, which means that we try to sell it as close to the farm gate as we possibly can.
How far do you get from Heckman's travel to get to from Washington State? What do you think? Florida, would you believe they grew in Goleta?
Even in the last 5 years, I've seen an increase in interest, not just in our food, but I think in organic food in general, and that helps a farm like us since we have been organic all these years.
After a decade of uncertainty, Fairview Gardens is finally safe, protected as a land trust and an educational institution called the Center for Urban Agriculture. The farm has become a model for others, from nearby schools to inner city neighborhoods. And people from around the world now contact Fairview Gardens for assistance in protecting their own farmland. But just as he did 20 years ago, Michael Abelman has new ideas about what this farm might become and how it might help change the world.
I believe that we need to go beyond organic. There are many large-scale organic farms whose labor practices are not so good, whose care of the soil is not so good, who are using the same industrial methods. Let's create an energy revolution in agriculture and learn how to farm without the incredible amount of diesel fuel and gasoline, and figure out ways to grow and to serve our local communities so that foods are not shipped these long distances. Large-scale organic farms began to adopt organic practices in the narrow sense of the word. They began eliminating the use of poisons. And I think we need to honor that. I think that's an important thing. It's a good step. But it's only the first step.
As the Fairview Gardens crew begins work on yet another morning, they have much to be proud of. In spite of many threats to its existence, this farm is still thriving, a symbol of a different kind of agriculture in tune with the melodies of life.
Any questions, comments, reactions?
Oh, you're a great film producer, John.
Thank you. I'm lucky to have interesting subjects to do. Yes.
How does one, I could see using this film in so many contexts, in our church community and in the broader church community, and in teaching in various contexts. How does one get a hold of it?
Again, it has the same distributor, Bullfrog Films, which is the leading environmental distributor, media distributor in the United States. 1-800-543-FROG. They're good folks, and they give special discounts for church groups and nonprofits and all those kind of things.
Okay.
They kind of make the people they hit hard with prices are the big universities and things.
Okay.
But
okay.
And so sometimes when you see in their catalog, the price will look quite high, but
okay.
They say just call them up. Nobody goes away without a tape. So.
Great.
You have that in print someplace here? I haven't. The 1-800?
No, I should. You know, that's something I just, I should have brought one of their catalogs and some other things, and if I'm ever doing this again, I will remember that. But I'm sorry, that's, there are really two video distributors that really have a lot of these kinds of films. One is Bullfrog, the other is a group called The Video Project.
Yeah.
And their number is 1-800-4, the number 4, Planet. Also a real good organization with a lot of social justice and environmental films. Bullfrog's focus tends to be more on the environmental, and I would say the Video Project more on the social justice and other issues, but both of them have some of each. Any other?
How do you pick, like, particularly with this film, did you know that you wanted to make a film about organic farming and then go out and look for a subject, or did this farm sort of come to you?
No, if the truth be told, I always make the joke that I haven't had an original idea in years. People always come to me with projects. And in this particular case, I got a call from Michael Abelman. He was in Seattle doing a speech for this organization, Seattle TILF, and Washington TILF. And he called me up and he said that he'd seen some of my work and he'd heard about me from, and I'd heard about him before, from a mutual friend, John Knox, who's the co-executive director of Earth Island Institute. And he said he was interested in having a film done about the farm because he was tired of having to go everywhere and speak all the time. He was always in demand, and he actually wanted to farm instead of speak. And he had a slideshow, which he took around, which was a very popular slideshow, a very good slideshow, and he talked with it, and he said it was very effective in that way. But they had thought to try to make a film, and the first one that they had done, they shot a little extra footage, and then they made the film kind of just like the slideshow. And he narrated it and said it didn't work. Everybody kind of agreed that it fell flat and just didn't have the same feeling as when he was there with it, and he needed a film in which you'd have. So we talked, he showed me the film itself, and what I suggested it needed was more storytelling. It was more about the issues and not much at all about the farm and this kind of thing. And what I suggested is that we make a film that would have more storytelling, including the story of the farm, a little bit of that kind of drama, and more of him, even though he was modest and actually didn't want that attention. I really felt that people need often in these kind of programs to connect with a character, to connect with some person who has the passion and the vision to drive these things forward. And Michael's a very good talker. I mean, he's very able to do that. So this is what I suggested. The nice thing was that we had the old footage, which is made, the historical footage, which is made to seem like it could be any time in the last 20 years, was actually shot about 6 years ago. But since Michael didn't have a beard then and other things, it looks like it could be older than that. And that was footage that was shot for the film that they made with the slideshow. But it was done in a way, again, in which the photographer shot beautiful stuff, but was much more interested in just doing take after take of this and that visual thing, and never did anything with characters or people or Michael, but it was a treasure trove of just visual images to be able to use them as, that's history, and what all the video that we shot in about a week spent at the farm, actually 4 days in April and 4 days in June, was we could use for present day. And then we had actually the good fortune of having a big storm hit in April when we were there, and so, you know, we weren't thinking about that, but then one day we're there and it's just wake up and it is like pouring, everything is, and it's like, oh no, we're not going to be able to shoot today, and all this stuff, and I think, no, there's another way we can handle this. We will shoot today and we'll use it to sort of create the drama of the problems that they face, you know, the rain coming down will be a sort of a symbol, visual symbol for that and for the storms and so forth. So it turned out that we were just very fortunate that occurred. But also, the fact was the development is still going on. This kind of stuff is just constant, so they're always building new houses. So the development that you saw being built is about 2 miles from the farm, but it was exactly the same feeling as what was going on. So I said to Michael, come on, we'll just get you over there and walk through this thing, and we'll use it so people get the feeling of what was actually going on, what you were experiencing when they were building the things right around you. Those things, of course, are already built, so we couldn't see them being built.
Part of the film, he mentioned the number of countries he went to. Do you know what countries he went to, besides Peru and China?
Well, I said 5 continents.
Five continents.
Yeah, I don't exactly know how many individual countries that he went to. So,
Has there been any movement to make a film that would sort of demonstrate all of the community-supported agriculture or sustainable agriculture in the Seattle area or the Western Washington or Central Western Washington area? I know there are many little projects. I just heard about something on Orcas Island and the Seattle Tilth, and there's something in South Seattle. And is there anything like that? Just
not
a call to visibility.
For that, I've been, when I showed this film at a conference at UC Davis, which is a big ag school.
Uh-huh.
And when we showed it afterwards, an individual from the U.S. Department of Agriculture came up to me and said that she was really interested in our doing a film that would be about efforts towards sustainable agriculture kind of all around the West, uh-huh. not so yeah. localized, but that yeah. would also include ranches that are changing and trying to take, you know, get away from the feedlot practices and those kind of things. It wouldn't be a strictly, and so we're talking about making that, it wouldn't be a strictly organic, although clearly
yeah.
some of the key ones featured would be
yeah.
completely organic,
yeah.
but it would also look at people who are trying to take steps at least in that direction, with integrated pest management
mm-hmm.
and other kind of systems, and it would look at both farms, ranches, and then at marketing practices,
mm-hmm.
including community-supported agriculture, farmers' markets, and other co-ops and new things that are being developed to try to get this stuff out. So I'm hoping that she's going to be able to find the resources from USDA and from some other places to make that possible. It's a nice sign for me. I mean, it is a positive thing for me to see that there really is strong interest in this kind of thing,
yeah.
even from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. That would not have been the case even 10 years ago. And to see that UC Davis, which used to be the chemical school of all chemical schools, has very much or become more oriented towards sustainable ag programs and things. I mean, this kind of thing would probably have been, at UC Davis even 15 years ago. And now, I mean, people are very, very supportive. So that's a positive thing, though.
Yeah.
In the state of Washington, I've gotten two flyers within the last 3 months where they even have all these grant programs, small grants for small ideas for sustainable living of all kinds. And the State Department of Natural Resources is a fabulous resource. And you don't have a film yet, but they do have a book called Our Changing Nature, which covers agriculture and water and all these different things, and helps you understand what the problems are, so you have that foundation. There's tons of free material that's available.
That's a very good point, and I actually last year did a film for them, but it's about community forestry, about the whole movement of people to do urban tree planting and to get that out. And actually the DNR of Washington State hired me to just do a short 10-minute video on that subject, which they're now using to try to get all these communities to do tree planting programs. So,
wow.
Yeah, Ron.
I think beyond the topics of sustainable agriculture here, some of the dynamics in the film are just so telling. And whatever justice work we're involved in, it's not the gardening, it's not dishing up a bowl of soup, or it's the things that wear us out, it's the politics that we encounter and all the obstacles and hurdles that come in our way that really burn us out in this kind of work. And and then their effort to build community relationships in order to come face to face with that political obstruction, I think it's just a powerful message here for whatever kind of justice work we're about.
Great. Well, that's what we were certainly hoping. And when I heard about the meal thing and that those kind of things, what they did to bring the neighbors around, I think that was great. And now I'd say, I went and talked with a few of the neighbors. I mean, I ended up not using a lot of that stuff just because I thought a little bit made the point, and there were other things I wanted to say in the 30 minutes. But the neighbors now who are all around the farm, the ones who complained, are almost universally supportive. The only one who's not is still the person whose swimming pool you saw. Grossman still absolutely hates the farm. Yeah. Still says that he wishes it were out of there completely. But everybody else, Linda Moriarty, who you saw, her husband was a former football star for the Houston Oilers, and he was, when they first moved in there, and they have a very pricey place, and when they moved in there, they were real negative. I mean, they were one of the leaders against the compost thing, the roosters, and the whole bit, but they have become completely changed and are huge supporters of the farm, give money and everything to it now. So I think that's a neat example of where that happened. Yeah. Didn't happen with everybody, but happened with most people. Yes, Ron.
I am just amazed that these people either buy something sight unseen or move in with a compost pile next to them, and then 6 months later suddenly wake up and say, oh, there's a compost pile next to
them. Well, so it could be the smell. They didn't buy during smelly season.
Ohio either has a law or is proposing a law that says, look, if you move next to a farm, you can't file a lawsuit when suddenly they have roosters. If they're there first, you better be careful where you buy.
But in Washington State, we have the same problem in Issaquah, which has recently been devastated. people were buying homes up in the hill, and as soon as they got up there, their small pets were being taken by coyotes. And instantly they wanted to set traps for the coyotes and everything, Like, oh, well, now we need to get rid of all the wildlife. I want to get rid of the coyotes and raccoons and then, any animal that was getting into their yard. So we want to move out where it's wild, but we want to get rid of all the wild.
Well, this is another issue that's happening as many, many people are actually even finding second homes and things like that right in great animal habitat areas. You certainly see this in areas around Yellowstone Park and places like that, where there's these greater and greater, human-animal negative interactions. And then people say, well, get the animals out, don't put more in. But the film will be is going to be shown on National Public Television sometime probably late next winter. It's not unlike Affluenza, which was in some of the other hour-long films, which were shown in what they call core time, which meant that all the stations kind of carry them at the same time. This being a half-hour show is not being fed in prime time. So stations will be picking it up and kind of running it as they want to do it. So if you're interested, you can let me know, and I'll let you know when the national feed is coming down, and you can, you know, tell your local stations to pick it up and carry it.
Mm-hmm. And the name of it is Beyond Organic.
Beyond Organic, Division of Fairview Gardens. Yeah. Yes, Tori.
In the showing of any of your films on public television, how do you approach commercials? You haven't had to deal with that at all?
No, because they're only the underwriting things that say who paid for the film, that sort of thing. And then public TV has its own little 1 minute or 2 minute commercials, but they never break up a program. So the program is run straight through without commercials.
Thank goodness.
Fortunately.
Yeah, good.
Now, what you saw, the film that you see, the version of the film you saw is 32 minutes long, so I had to take 5 minutes out for the public television broadcast, because the public television half hour is actually 27 minutes. But I don't think it's affects it too much, but I did have to take out a few little things, and I don't think most people would notice, but the people who are really into the farm, they'll notice. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.